There's a book written by Diana Mutz, an American sociology professor, called Hearing the Other Side, which is kind of like throwing a bucket of cold water over what we've been talking about today. Her expertise is in understanding how people develop the capacity for deliberating with each other.
Just move that a fraction up, you, because it's just a little quiet. There we go.
Good. And she looks, she got a lot of empirical evidence about people's personal networks and how having people on your personal network who politically disagree with you or have different values from you is very important for preparing you for being able to do the kind of things that we do when we have a collaborative session. And she asserts and produces a lot of evidence to show that most people don't have this. And that's really the big dilemma when you're trying to think about, can we do this kind of thing in Waikikamukau or somewhere? Collaborative governance is at its heart a deliberative process. It's a process in which people who have different values nonetheless manage to reach an agreement around a policy which feels comfortable to them but which doesn't violate their values. It's something they can feel comfortable with and see as a solution. So you have to understand it as a deliberative process, which is one of the two great ideals which is buried in the concept of democracy. The other one's participation. And what Deborah Mutz is saying in her book basically is that participation and deliberation are two quite different things, and they are actually in conflict with each other. And this conflict gives rise to a lot of the difficulties that we have in working out how best to do collaborative governance. And she's basically saying that if you go to small town America, which she's a real expert in, there's a huge amount of social capital there where people trust each other, they have strong social networks, they help each other out, but they do not understand gays or environmentalists or people of different ethnicities and so on. And in order to deliberate, you have to have another kind of social capital, which she calls, or which other theorists have called, bonding social capital, which is the capital that, in the networks that are across values and which enable people who disagree on a number of fundamental things to nonetheless reach an agreement around the table of a collaborative process. So when you see a big demonstration going down Queen Street, there's a lot of people there who have a lot of bonding social capital, but not all of them, bonding social capital, but not all of them also have the bridging social capital, the capacity to disagree, or the capacity to reach some agreement, some modus vivendi with people who want to do mining somewhere. This little sentence is a pretty sobering one and gives you a sense of what Deborah Mutz sees as the kind of unreality of deliberation or collaborative governance. Exchanges between citizens of equal status, very hard to get that in real life, who offer reasonable, carefully constructed and morally justifiable arguments, hard to get those, to one another in a context of mutual respect, that doesn't always come. Participants must provide reasons for their positions that speak to the needs of everyone affected. That's very challenging too. So these are all sort of needed characteristics of a good deliberative process. And Deborah Mutz's point is this is so hard to get. These conditions are so hard to get. There's also some more barriers. I've just put up this diagram, which is taken from a famous critique of PowerPoint presentations, which is basically saying the world's a bit too complex for PowerPoint, and going into Afghanistan with a few bullet points wasn't a great idea. It actually, there's quite a lot more. If you look closely at that diagram, there's quite a bit to it. And complexity means that the participants in these processes need to have both an ability and a motivation to learn, because more than anything else, a collaborative process is essentially a learning process in which you learn a lot of technical information, you also learn a lot about other people's viewpoints, and you actually have to have quite a bit of learning capacity and understanding to be able to come out of that in a constructive way. With a constructive outcome. But for Deborah Mutz, the key factor in the success of these is not just a capacity to learn. It's also having had exposure on personal networks to opposing political perspectives and an awareness of their rationale. And she often tests people by saying, you know, have you ever had a political discussion with someone on your personal network that you disagreed with? Only 23% of Americans say yes to that question. And then she asks, well, if you've had such a discussion, can you explain to me what the reason they hold that view is? And very few Americans are able to explain to you why somebody they disagree with that they know quite well holds to the view that they hold. So this is small town America, and New Zealand is not devoid of small town characteristics as well. And this is the challenge that we have to face in trying to decide in a particular situation, have we got the people here that could make this thing happen? We also have this institutional context. And maybe I see many of the people here from the social sector, and perhaps it's all different, but certainly in the environmental sector, we have the Resource Management Act. It prioritises participation over deliberation. And when you go out and you try and get participatory and you ask the community to give you their views on something, you tend to tap the extremes. This little character in the picture is, you know, you will have met him many times. If not at a council hearing, you'll have certainly heard them on talkback radio. These extremes are people that don't need to address each other, they just need to address the decision maker. Often very forcefully. Each side hires their own experts who will say that the science that we've understood supports us. And the decision makers that they're addressing are not necessarily representative of the community as a whole. And because of the structure of the RMA and the appeal rights and the ability to appoint commissioners and appeal those to the Environment Court and so on, you can bypass the elected representatives. And most controversial issues, the elected representatives are bypassed. And when you ask the elected representatives to come to a policy framework, what you often get is quite vague, or it's quite deadlocked, and we don't get further ahead. So I thought I'd say a few words about the Canterbury Water Management Strategy, which tried to address this problematic context in, for the most part, out there in rural Canterbury. And it tried to get around some of these difficulties by not inviting everybody to send a representative along, as Alistair has just described the Land and Water Forum did, but rather by selecting people that they thought would be collaborative, that had the right characteristics that Deborah Mutz might have said you needed. But in order to give this group of people some legitimacy and some understanding of the wider community's views, they ran three quite good, quite comprehensive rounds of public participation in which people were invited to make input and attend hearings and meetings and so on. They also provided a huge amount of what you might call official guidance to the group around some quite helpful concepts that helped the group to find where there was common ground. One of them was a concept called parallel development, which essentially meant that we've got production interests, we've got environmental interests, and going forward, each stage has got to deliver something for both sides. And they got people to think about it in that way and to design a sort of trajectory going forward in which each move was going to be balanced with a benefit for the other side. Another concept they had was that of creating incentives for voluntary change. So you have all these farmers, these irrigators who own water rights. They actually own more water rights than there is water in Canterbury. And the question is, how do you get them to use less? And there are two sources of new water. One is to build some dams, if only the environmentalists would agree to that. And the other one is to get the farmers to make better use of their existing water by using more efficient irrigation systems. And the idea was that by offering them some new water from a dam, you might get them to voluntarily relinquish their existing water permit, which is a legal right to take water for 35 years. So there are sort of mechanisms in here which was quite strongly promoted by officials and which the members of the group picked up and carried forward and built consensus around. But it was quite a steered process, much more so than the Land and Water Forum. And it was driven, and I think it's important to understand, it was driven by a pre-existing situation of crisis in water in Canterbury, not just in the shortage of water for irrigation, but also in the quality of water and the degradation of lowland streams, which were having less and less water flowing down them as the farmers pumped more and more out of the groundwater and discharged more and more dairy waste into the streams. So there was a sense of crisis in Canterbury, and there was a deadlock in the existing statutory process about how to deal with it. Will this work, this guided approach to collaborative governance? And it's probably a little bit early to make a judgment, but I have to make one by this Friday when I put in my report on it to the Ministry for the Environment. And I guess what I'm saying is that it does appear to be working. It is changing the culture down there. That is partly, of course, for a completely extraneous reason, which is that the government abolished the normal democratic rights which people would have to get rid of Environment Canterbury councillors, because the government did that for them, and put in their own people, and also changed the rules about water conservation orders so people could no longer felt it was worth applying for them. So a lot of the existing alternatives to collaborating disappeared with the Environment Canterbury legislation. There are some risks if some aspects of the strategy don't get delivered. For example, we don't yet know whether these dams that they propose to build to yield some of the new water are actually commercially viable propositions. And there's a belief that perhaps they're not and there'll have to be a government subsidy, and we don't know in these straitened financial circumstances in which we find ourselves nowadays whether the government will subsidise the dams. Nor whether the government will subsidise the parallel development of environmental improvement. And if either of those bits of money is not made available, then the trust behind this process will be lost and the whole thing will fall into the pre-existing dysfunctional politics that there was beforehand. There's also a risk that a number of irrigation projects are using the current statutory process and they may get consented in a way which is at variance with the strategy. And if that happens, then that would be another cause for the whole thing to break down. So there are huge risks here, and the trust has been built up despite these risks, but it still could all turn to custard. And the last one I just touch on is that there is still a risk which really sprang from that problem that these people are not self-nominated participants. They were carefully selected by a group of officials at Environment Canterbury. And when I got down to the Mackenzie Basin, where I was setting up another collaborative process, because there was a potential overlap with Environment Canterbury's one, I tried to negotiate a memorandum of understanding between the Mackenzie people and Environment Canterbury as to how we're going to proceed. And when we got to the big meeting in Twizel, the local people said, we don't want Environment Canterbury's process. We don't like the people they've chosen for the committee. So we're not going to sign up this memorandum of agreement. So you can see a sort of an early warning signal that this idea of choosing people to represent the farmers in particular isn't necessarily something which is going to stick in the long term. And the same issue with iwi standing here in their polluted Te Waihora Lake Ellesmere. I'll leave it there. There's a lot, I think, for us to discuss. Thank you very much.